At long last, ladies and gentlemen, season 5 of Chewing the Gristle is indeed upon us. A convivial conversation fest between myself, Gregory S. Cawk, Esquire, and a variety of musical potentates from hither and yon. Brought to you by our friends at Wildwood Guitars and our friends at Fishman Transducers, of course, both of which I've had long-standing and continuing relationships with, and I'm very grateful for their continued support in this endeavor to bring you Chewing the Doggone Gristle. We've got a bunch of fun guests, some you have heard of, some maybe not so much. It'll be a little bit of discovery and a little bit of chaos all rolled into one. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Now, without any further ado, let's chew some gristle. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we gather again for a mighty conversation with our friend Mike Zito, guitar player, vocalist extraordinaire, bluesman, rock and roller, cool dude, incendiary music. Can you dig it? We had a fun conversation this week. It's Mike Zito on Chewing the Gristle. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the time has come once again for another robust and delicious convivial conversation here on Chewing the Gristle with yours truly, Gregory Cawkery. We have the mighty Mike Zito, guitar player extraordinaire, vocalist extraordinaire, blues cat, cool dude. He's with us today live from, it looks like, his homestead. What's going on, Mike Zito? What's happening?
You've made me sound so much cooler than I actually am. I think I'll leave right now. Let's just be done. And I'll do a Costanza and end on a high note.
Well, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Greg. How are you, buddy?
You know what? I can't complain. Home for a little stretch here, then going back out again. I know you're probably getting ready to go out and rock the free world. What do you got planned for this year? I know you and Albert did so many shows last year, and you were out and about doing the do and all that kind of stuff. And this year strikes a new chord for us all. What the hell's going on?
All right. Well, you're right. Albert and I did Blood Brothers, and last year that was kind of the focus. But the plan is that this year we will do Blood Brothers, but it's there's no new recordings. We're doing our own thing, and then we'll get together and like maybe play a festival or some things like that. But we're not touring as Blood Brothers this year. So this year, Albert has a record that'll come out this summer, and he'll be touring. But I made a record in September at Sunset Sound Recorders, which was amazing. It was produced by our buddy Joe Bonamassa and Josh Smith, our buddies. Yes. They're pretty good. And right. they helped me make this kind of a very, I don't want to say difficult, just very important recording that I made called Life is Hard. And it comes out next month, February 23rd on Gulf Coast Records. And that's what I'm going to be doing this year.
Now, I was going to say, you have your own label that you've been doing the with. So this is coming out on your label.
It comes out on my label.
Not on Gulf Keeping Coast the Blues Alive Records or anything like that.
No. And you know, Joe's good like that. Joe and Josh also first produced the Blood Brothers album, which again is on my label. And I so wanted them to work with us, and I'm glad they did. But yeah, my concern was, Joe probably doesn't want to do it if it's not on Keeping the Blues Alive. But of course he was like, yeah, that doesn't matter at all. I love you guys. I want to work together. And so we found a way that it works for everybody.
Awesome.
So it isn't them.
Excellent. And what kind of musical selections do you have on there? I mean, I know maybe people aren't aware, but you lost your lovely wife this past year, and my condolences on that. That was horrifying.
And, thank you.
And I know that this record is probably influenced by that experience.
It was. And you know, she helped me start this record label, really kind of try to build this music career over the past 20 years. And so, look, not to be a bummer, we knew she had so long to live. And last year, this time, her and I were planning the idea of, well, you're going to make a record about this. She would joke and tease me, well, you said you hadn't had anything right about her, anything to sink your teeth into. Well, here you go, you know. That's what this is. It's Life is Hard is the name of the album. And it's a blues record. Like, I've kind of always steered clear of making a blues record. I'm throwing up finger quotations because, I don't know that I'm can say that I can do that. Some of my stuff is bluesy and I like to play blues. I mean, I love it. I know you do too. But I try to, that I just do my own thing. This time it was like, I'm going to make a blues record. I can do this. I felt like I gave myself the allowance to make a blues record.
Yes,
you know, this was a bluesy situation.
Yeah.
And so we picked a lot of cover or old songs, blues songs that, you know, that kind of tell that everyone can relate to. You're losing a love. The woman has walked out on you. We put it together and made a really great story. I did write a couple of songs. One, I think, is one of the best songs I've ever written. And so it's a great record. It's not a completely devastatingly sad, awful, people are going to be miserable if they listen to it record. But it's a blues record, you know? And so it's got a lot of emotion. And sometimes I could sink my teeth into the guitar playing when I didn't feel like I could sing or write a song. And man, those guys, they just killed it. They were unbelievable.
Awesome.
You know? Yeah.
Now, I hate it when people, you know, always feel compelled to compare stuff to folks. But so take this in the right spirit. But you remind me of your vocals and material and the fact that there is that rock element. And it reminds me of Delbert McClinton. Now, would that be a fair assessment?
That'd be the greatest compliment that any person could bestow upon me.
So, excellent.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, he's one of my all-time heroes. And ironically, I'm going to see him this weekend because I'm going on his cruise.
Nice.
Perform. So, yeah.
Awesome.
I love him to death. He's amazing.
Now, when you were in Milwaukee, you played with the trio. Is that what you're mostly going to be doing this year? Is that kind of the approach? You're going to have a little larger ensemble?
Yeah. No, it's normally, that was kind of unprecedented at that time. It's usually a four-piece band. So there's usually my piano player. His name is Lewis Stevens. He plays piano and organ. He's almost always with the band. He just didn't happen to be on that tour. So it'll be four piece. And I mean, Lewis has played with me longer than anybody, almost 13 years. And a side note, Lewis was Freddie King's piano player back
in awesome.
The last 5 or 6 years. So he's got a lot of great stories.
I remember seeing him on those old videos. Those were some of those videos are just so awesome from that 70s period.
He's easy to spot in the band.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Correct.
Yes.
So what is your scheduled departure to start conquering this year? So you're doing the Delbert thing. How do you like those cruises, by the way? I saw you on the Joe cruise. I mean, the cruises are they're fun, right?
I had a ball when we were on the cruise, and I really do. I really look forward to them. I think they're to me, it's like that's the one of the best things I get to do. One, because your lovely wife was there, your son. We get to bring loved ones or families or a date, or it's like you get a free cruise.
Right.
I've never been on a cruise before.
Same here. Absolutely.
So, I do enjoy that. I enjoy that I get to see everybody play because we don't get to do that either. We're on tour. We're working. So
right.
I love that. Sometimes there's collaborations or I've written songs. So I enjoy the cruises. Yeah, the cruise is the first thing I do. But really the beginning of this year and a lot of the beginnings of my year, if I do it right, January and February, I don't have a lot of work. I'm kind of more home with my girls, or I'm working on the record label. I just do some weekends or this cruise. Really, the beginning of March, like March 1st, is the beginning of the Life is Hard tour. And that is a 26-date tour over 32 days.
Oh, man.
All through, it's up and down the East Coast in the northeastern part of the United States. It's a big, full, plentiful tour.
There's a lot of humans up there.
There are, and they're great music fans.
Yes.
And they love guitar and blues and rock and roll. And I love it to death. So we're that's kind of my big tour. And then we get a little break, and then we do a West Coast tour in May. And then in the summer we do festivals and intermingled in there, there'll be a Blood Brothers festival where I fly out and meet Albert and we do a show. And I'm happy with the way things are right now. I used to do 250 shows a year, right, Greg, and I don't have to do that so much anymore.
Yes.
It's hard.
Well, it's interesting because last year we probably had our busiest year with the band ever, as usually I'm doing all these other different things as well, which I continue to do. So it was a busy year, but man, it's you look back over the year and you can't really get a grasp on time. It's like, was that this year or was that last year? Was that 3 years ago that we went on there?
Yes.
It's like, oh no, that all happened last year.
Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, we get at the end of a 4 week tour and you think back to the first week and it's like, what? When was that? That's like a year ago. No, it was a couple weeks ago. It was just a few weeks ago. It's all consuming.
It is. Do you still enjoy the road? I love it.
I do. I do. Of course I do. And I'll always do it. Always. I love the people. I love going and seeing the people. I'm like you. I know that you're like this. I like to play every night. I want it to be live. My chops get good halfway through the tour. I don't play many solos the same way twice. I'm trying to teeter between Delbert McClinton and, Ronnie Earl or Jimmy Vaughn or Gary Moore, trying to play enough guitar, but I'm trying to also sing. And right. So I like all of that. Like 4 weeks, we're not that young anymore, I don't think.
Yes, this is unfortunately true.
So I keep thinking if I can do a 2 week tour, that sounds really good to me. That would be pretty good. So
yeah, 2 weeks is a good amount. I mean, 3 weeks is doable. A month it gets long. But I enjoy it. I mean, a lot of people, will ask, man, how can you do it? And I'm like,
you know what?
It's like you go out and you're playing at clubs where the only reason people are showing up is to see you. It's not like, oh, look, there's a band here, right?
And
that's the upside and the downside. If people don't show up, well, there's that. But at least the people that you're not playing for somebody who's going to be yelling out stupid shit, requesting whatever. And they're all there to see you. And at afterwards, you're hanging out. They're so glad you came to their area. You have this awesome experience. You play early. I mean, usually you're on at 8. You're done by 10. You're packing up.
Absolutely.
You're out of there. And then we travel with just the three of us, right? So it's we stop when we want. We stay where we want. And it's you're just free. it's a free thing.
I absolutely agree. People always ask, how do you do it? How do you do it? And of course, we have help. The drive-in, the traveling. It's a lifestyle that you get used to. And I've always loved traveling. I enjoy it. And I always look forward to seeing my friends. I always tell people, if you can make friends with these fans, friends will always come support you.
Right.
And that's what I enjoy doing is talking with them, hanging out with them. And I grew up playing in bars and clubs and I like playing loud.
Yes.
And I like being in front of people and I like that magic. I'm addicted to it. There's some point in any night where something's going to happen. It's like, was okay. Great. That happened. That was it. And that's hard to describe. I think the people that don't always play music, maybe they don't play with groups. They don't quite get that. Something crazy and magical and might happen usually happens.
Yes.
And when it does, that's it.
That's exactly correct.
That's why we go back again.
Yeah, the playing never gets old. I mean, it's that is always the funnest part. I mean, yeah, the, you know, but the traveling, you know, it just, I was telling my wife the other day, it's like, you know, I've got, you know, not to be all, you know, live in the moment type of thing, but you know, it is. I mean, just the fact of like, hey, we figured out how to get to the gig. We got a place to park our vehicle. We got a cool hotel not too far away. It's like every one of those little things are little victories.
Yes.
Yeah. So like, great. There's enough people here. You know, hey, they bought a bunch of merch. We're good.
Yeah. It's like, it's so rewarding to just go, hey, look, we made money and everyone's happy and we got a free meal and we get to play. And so, you know, but then it's great that when it goes even beyond that, you know,
yes.
And you fill the room and you know, the, obviously all that is never ending. And for me, you know, I'm going to go play no matter what, even if I'm older and I own my own club,
right?
like I got to go play. Hey, I got a question for you because we have known each other or of each other for a long time, but just this is kind of it'll tie into what we're talking about. But how educated are you on the guitar music? Like did you go to school or did you teach yourself or did you?
I did go to school. I took some lessons in high school that were. You know, I played in jazz band, you know, in high school and got a little, high school scholarship to go to this jazz camp per se. I was never, you know, a quote unquote jazz guitar player, but you know, obviously I liked those elements of things and I wanted to know what I was doing. And, you know, but my focus was always on the kind of music I've always done, which is this hodgepodge. It's kind of, you know, the strongest flavor is kind of the blues rock thing, but there's jazz, there's funk, there's country, you know, all that crazy shit thrown in there. That's always been kind of my thing. And I always wanted to have my own band, but you know, my dad, I was the youngest of seven kids and my dad was a lawyer and was just not pleased with my choice to pursue music. He was supportive, but he was horrified because he, you know, everyone that he knew that was choosing the life of a musician, you know, it was a rough life. Then, you know,
right, right.
And he's not wrong, but, you know, and he talked to every one of the teachers I ever had, said, talk them out of it. Tell them how your life is. And I'm like, Dad, you're literally telling all these guys, hey, you guys are losers. Tell my son how shitty it is. So I went to a college in University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, where the guy that was the guitar player at this camp that I went to in high school actually ran the jazz department. And that was a unique thing because, you know, he was a jazz guy per se, but he was open-minded. And so he recognized what I did and, you know, and wanted to add to it. Whereas a lot of jazz educators back then, I don't know if it's still the same or just in my experience, it was one of those things where if you bent a string and played a solid body guitar, you were a heretic, you know?
Yeah, and, right.
Sure, and sure. Everyone from, you know, ABBA to Led Zeppelin to Yes to Jimi Hendrix was that rock shit in their mind. You know what I mean?
Right,
it was all
right.
Just that heretical pablum in comparison to the, you know, the heady bebop and so on and so forth that they were into. But it was a good experience. I mean, I'd never wanted to be, you know, because back then they kind of focused you into either being an educator, like going to be a band teacher or whatever the case may be, or they were preparing you to be a lounge musician. Because at that time, you know, back in the days, you probably remember, you know, you could make a decent living playing on cruise ships. You still can, I guess, but or playing, you know, Holiday
Inn circuit. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah.
You know, you'd set up shop at a Holiday Inn and, you know, one week after another, you'd be traveling around. And I wanted to do neither of those things. I wanted to, you know, do my own band, you know, maybe play with some of the people that I really looked up to as an interim thing to get my feet wet. And so I learned enough stuff to be able to read decently, to be able to score decently at a professional level, and then to be able to play over changes if it came to and be cognizant of a little bit more sophisticated harmony. But that was an ongoing process. I mean,
Sure.
I was always adding to the soup, but that was kind of the goal of what I went to school for. And I didn't actually graduate. I went for 4 years. I still had some, you know, general degree requirement stuff that I had to do. And by that time I was gigging all the time. And I just said, Dad, listen, you know, a degree is not going to do me any good as a performance guy. So I need to get out of here. I can't be stuck in this, you know, little town.
Right.
He was horrified. And then years later, he's like, you know, it always bummed me out that you didn't get your degree. I go, yeah, Dad, but I was hired to teach at a college, so we're good.
Well, that to me, that sounds perfect. I mean, obviously I'm totally aware of your amazing ability as a guitar player, musician, and, you know, I've stood on stage and watched you play, and but I'm there's still, you know, I can tell you have more education than I do. But you still have that openness to like, let's see what happens.
Right.
I don't know if all of the jazz, you know, like heavy jazz musicians, maybe not, even if they're improvising. Hold on one moment. I'll get through that.
No worries.
But again, I don't know what I'm talking about. I mean, no one played music in my family. I asked for a guitar when I was 7 after I heard Eruption. And then I got the guitar and plugged it in and it did not play Eruption. And I was like, this is broken.
Behold.
I thought this is what a guitar does. I just banged and beat on it till I met guys in high school that could tune it and play. And then I realized, okay, I don't know how to play. I did get a couple of lessons. I'm going to brag a little now. My first guitar teacher for my first two guitar lessons was Richard Fortus, who is guitarist in Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
But he wasn't then. He was just a 17-year-old kid teaching at Encore Music in Afton, Missouri.
Sure.
Like by my house. And he's a great guy. We're great friends. But but there was a music store right by my house, 3 blocks from where I lived my entire life, that was a Fender PV, you know, repair lessons, blah, blah, blah. And I started working there right out of high school at 18. And I worked there for a decade. So that's my going to college.
Yep.
All of the musicians, all the guitar players, all the guys that played gigs that worked from country to jazz to R&B to rock, whatever, they were all coming in. And I would get to see them play great, great musicians, you know. I also did get, about maybe 6 or 7 months of these music lessons from this guy that taught music in his parents' basement in the county in St. Louis. It's called South County. And that's who all of these, including Rich Fortus, that's who all these guys went to. He was like a college credit. And you had to get on a waiting list with this guy. His name is Duke Michalak. I don't know if he teaches anymore yet, Duke. It was like, oh, you got to get in with Duke, man. You got to, you know, it was like, you're going to learn the modes. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I was like, what does this mean? I don't understand, you know? And so I got in with him when I was like 19, and this is just the sweetest, nicest, wonderful dude. And he would, he certainly played guitar, but he played piano and he had a drum machine and he would show you like the major scale and you would practice it. And then he would go, okay, let's jam. And he would like put some music on and play piano and go, okay, play the scale, but don't play the scale. And I go, what? What do you mean? And he goes, well, you play those notes, but like make up a melody or something. Like, don't play them in order.
Right.
And it was like, wow, okay. And so I would work on that. He'd record the music and give you a tape, and you could take it home and you could practice it. And we do that all through these modes of the major scale. And so about 6 or 7 months in, I was there one day, and of course I was just practicing nonstop and playing and was playing in a band. And man, we finished one day and he goes, hey, I think that's it. You're good. And I was like, what? No, I don't know anything. And he goes, no, this is good. You, that's enough. You're good. Like, you got it. And I said, I don't have any, like, what did I do? Why are you not, you know, like, he goes, I promise you got it. Just go play. If you do any more, it's going to ruin it.
Ah, awesome.
And I said, okay. And I left and very, just totally confused. maybe 3 or 4 years later, one day I was at that music store and I went, Oh, okay, wow, that's really easy. I get it. And I called him up and told him, and he goes, oh, yeah, I knew you would. Oh, I'm glad. Enjoy yourself. Like, not jazz, just I get it. I get how the major scale works.
Right.
I get how everything works over, and it just all of a sudden made sense to a point where it was like, this is good. And there was enough guys that would come around and go, yeah, if you learn any more, you'll have to forget it when you play. And I remember thinking, okay, that seems weird. There's this part of me now as I'm older, man, I really want to get, I would love to get like a degree or take classes or just before I die to go, hey, I think I know what I'm doing, but I'd love to be able to say it out loud and not think I'm an idiot in front of someone. But I do enjoy the, I don't know, maybe this is right. Let's see. And then when it kind of really happens, that is still really exciting to me to have a moment like that, you know? Oh, I know you do. Cause I mean, I think it's available at all levels, but I don't know, maybe not when you're like, just know everything so much. I don't know. You might be referencing. And I think I reference, but then sometimes things just happen. I'm like, wow, what was that?
Right.
I don't know how to do that.
I was talking about this with, we talked about this a couple times on the podcast where it's like, if you, you know, like when I went to school, I never did some people, when they went to school, it was really hardcore. Like they'd go around the room in their ear training class and they would just say a chord and you would have to be able to just say all the notes of the chord and they'd be, and you have to do it like this and you'd have to sing it, or they would give you a note and you'd have to do, I mean, this really hardcore.
Wow.
Ear training exercise. And I did ear training. But I never really had that, you know, where you're scared shitless, where they just beat it into you. And as a result, I mean, I've got pretty good relative pitch. You know, I can see my way through a lot of different situations. But when I hear something, sometimes it's like, I still have to grab my guitar and figure it out. It's not like I can just pull those notes out of the air. Sometimes I can, but if it goes by, you know, really fast or something like that, I still have to get my guitar and kind of suss it out. And whereas I think some people, their ear is so advanced, right, that they can just hear something and go, oh, well, that's this interval, and just kind of write it down. And that's kind of that old school level of ear training. But to your point, I mean, I still get surprised by shit. I'm like, oh, this should work. But, you know, and you're like, oh, that's cool. So not saying that that's, you know, an excuse not to know, to train your ear to the greatest extent. All I know is that I like the fact that I still am surprised.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Like, it's still very enjoyable to have that kind of, oh, wow. It makes me want to pick the guitar up and continue to play it. And I think I probably have pretty good relative pitch. What I do know is, again, you know, technically, like, I'm probably not always playing the guitar the way you're supposed to play the guitar. But I'll find the note. Like, I'm going to play it.
Right.
It may not be the correct fingering or the way you're supposed to do it, but I'll do it. If I can get it in my hand and we can play through it, I'll find a way to get the notes that I'm trying to get. Yeah. But again, I'm not playing very complicated music at all.
Well, it's, as I like to say, it's simple, but it ain't easy.
You know, you'll remember this and you'll love this, but, you know, I just adored Danny Gatton.
Yes,
and I know absolutely. You did too. I mean, he was just unbelievable. And we played that Hot Licks Danny Gatton guitar videotape in our music store every day. It was like on a loop in one of those TVs that had the VCR. And it was just always on loop, you know. And I remember him playing a G13, and he just played like the triad. And he goes, I think this is a 13. It's in G. I don't know. There's not 13 notes. I don't know why they call it that. I was like, he doesn't know why. This is great. I have a chance possibly at playing music because this guy's unbelievable.
Right. Well, like, that's like George,
I don't know.
Like George Benson and And Wes Montgomery, they didn't know what the theory. I mean, they knew it intrinsically what the, you know, to play it because right. that's, you know, but that also speaks to the fact that, you know, that's the music that they grew up wanting to play was jazz. So, you know, their eruption or whatever you want to say, or whatever, you know, right. Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore or B.B. King Live at the Regal. Theirs was just yeah. the Great American Songbook. So they just had those harmonies in their head. And right. so that's the kind of things that they would figure out on their, you know, so, but they didn't know what the hell they were doing. If someone said, well, play the whole tone scale, I'd be like, oh, what? And then they're like, you know, this thing, oh, that thing, you know?
Yeah, but, right.
But it's crazy. I mean, but, and, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Did you see Danny live, or did you ever meet him? Or did
I
you,
did. As a matter of fact, I've got a picture over here that he's signed. We did a show for him, and he signed it. He goes, dude, Greg, you're terrific, and that's no shit.
Was that when you were at Fender?
No, I mean, I had just started to do, the guys at Fender were trying to help me out at that point, but I wasn't, you know, I maybe had done a clinic for them at that point. No, I think this is even before I'd done any clinics.
I'm positive that's where we met.
Okay. Okay.
2003 in Scottsdale.
Does yes. That sound? That's about
I
right.
I was just hired on at Fender and you were, and we were doing our training and you came in and did I want to say almost like an overall thing you were playing, and you had the Cyber Twin. That was the new thing.
Oh shit. Yeah.
And you were kind of testing it out, and that's what we had to do. We had to go, you know, I had to go to the stores and like kind of sit with the Cyber Twin and show the guys how it worked and demo it. And, you know, I had to audition guitar playing with Alan Waite.
Good old Alan Waite.
Yeah, he was a great, great,
bless
great
his soul.
Guy. Yes, wonderful man. So, yeah, I didn't know if maybe that's when, because I knew they were doing the Danny guitar. I never met Danny Gatton, but I did see him live once.
We did a show with him at Shankall, as a matter of fact. And it was us, Danny Gatton, and Mick Taylor was the headliner. So
Wow.
We played, and then Danny played. And after we got done playing, Danny's band and our band had to share the same dressing room because Mick Taylor was a headliner, so he got the other dressing room. So I just remember at that time I played a Strat, a Super Reverb, and so I remember I just was coming off stage with my shit, you know, and I walked up, and I just see Danny sitting against the wall going like this, and he looks up, he goes, you the guitar player? I'm like, yeah. He's like, man, that was great. He comes over and was just like the nicest dude.
Oh, that's
and perfect. I still have the legal pad where he wrote down his name, his address, and his phone number. He said, call me anytime, I'd be glad to help you out in any way that I can. He was just totally, totally cool.
That's
and of
wonderful.
Course he was mind-blowing live. And what I loved so much about seeing him was, you know, at that point I had done quite a bit of, you know, when you're younger, you try to open up for whoever you can because you just want that experience and you want to rub shoulders and do all that kind of shit. So we had done
absolutely
a lot of the guitar players du jour. And what I liked so much about Danny is that it was a primarily instrumental show. It might've been at that point, all instrumental show, but he understood how to entertain. You know what I mean? He was an entertainer.
Right.
The show rocked. He had it paced in such a way where it was not shoegazing. It was not, you know, a total chops fest, although it was, but he understood how to entertain. And that's the
white melodies that I just play songs on the guitar. And he was humorous and funny yes. with yes. his instrument. There's really no one quite like him.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And he did that thing that I fell in love with. It was like, what is this? You know, it's country, jazz, blues, rock and roll. Blue. It was just kind of everything, but all at once
right.
in any given song.
Yes, exactly.
Sure, there might be a country song and he played country, but he also play a bunch of country licks in the middle of a blues song or whatever. Like,
exactly.
It was just, you know, yep. And that's what you do. And I love that about you.
Well,
you
thank know? You, sir.
I try to do that. I just kind of play what I play over what I play. And it has always been a little bit of a hodgepodge of country or blues, you know, things that I do. But, you know, I'm not at that level. But
I think it's, you know, in this day and age, you've got, you know, people that do the blues thing in a real traditional sense. There always have been those individuals.
Sure, sure.
And I dig that. I'm a fan, you know, of people that do kind of a real steeped in the tradition of Chicago or whatever particular blues avenue that they're mm-hmm. going for, and they add some new life in it, and they kind of speak in that language of that period of time, but do it in a contemporary way. And then you got the turbo kind of contemporary blues where it's really kind of over the top and it rocks, and you know, it is what it is, and people love that, and so on and so forth.
Sure.
But it's still considered blues, you know? And you know, as you were saying, it's like, I like to throw a bunch of different stuff in there, and people are like, well, that's not blues. And I'm like, well, right. Yeah, it is, actually. I mean, if you, that's like when we do a blues, I mean, it's got all the real shit in there because I've learned, right. studied, and did all that stuff. But it's interesting because you find people who need to have very defined
sure.
You know, structure.
And same with country music. I mean, same. Yeah. You've got those people that this Jason Aldean or whoever. I'm not always so current on new country, but oh, that's not country music or that's not blues music. And right. I mean, to me, the things evolve. And honestly, I've never, ever claimed to be, I'm a blues artist. I'm a white kid that grew up in the middle of St. Louis. So I grew up listening to rock and roll, but it turned out the rock and roll I liked. Some older guys that I worked at the store said, so you like blues? And I said, oh, do I? I don't know. I mean, I was listening to Johnny Winter, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton, Led Zeppelin.
Right.
You know, just the usual 70s and 80s. But they were like, yeah, but that's like kind of bluesy rock. And then somebody put on Live at the Regal. I was 18 and I was like, wow, this is like my dad's big band records, but the guy's playing cool guitar.
Right.
And I fell in love with it, you know? So I've never claimed to say I'm a blues artist, but there has been room in the blues genre of the world for me to do my thing. But I've been doing it long enough that I remember years, 10, 15 years ago, I put a record out. That's country music. That's not blues. Like, no, well, okay. Because there's four chords, I guess, rather right. than three. Like, there was an extra chord. I'm sorry. I just kind of do my thing, and I know you do the same. You do your. We just do our thing, and people gravitate to it if they like it. And I just let them decide what it is.
Right.
I, obviously, when I release a record, the distributor releases it in blues. But like you said to me, when that comes to that case, it's a big genre. There's room for a lot. And I just don't ever really think about it. My goal always has been, I'm going to do a Mike Zito show.
Yeah.
That's what I want it to be. And I want to be able to do a little bit of all the things I like.
Right.
You know?
We interrupt this regularly scheduled gristle-infested conversation to give a special shout-out to our friends at Fishman Transducers, makers of the Greg Kock signature Fluence gristle tone pickup set. Can you dig that? And our friends at Wildwood Guitars of Louisville, Colorado, bringing the heat in the shadow of the Rocky Mountains.
What are you playing, right? What are you doing? Are you playing the Koch amps or the Kock amps?
Yeah, I mean, when
playing
I go
your Gristle Man amp, your...
Well, lately what I do is I'm using the head and 212 cabinet version of the Kock amp, the Greg.
And yeah, the Greg.
I bring an extra head along just in case something transpires. And then I usually bring three guitars. I bring usually a couple of my Reverend Gristle Masters, which is my you know, souped up Tele with my special pickups, larger body, all that shit. And then I have a P90 version. Which I usually have two tuned to open G for slide, but lately I've got this this three tone Sumbers one. I know our listeners can't see it, but I want to show it to you. There.
Oh, that's good looking. Oh,
it's
and
got
a big,
the big
cool.
P on it, and it's got my I worked with Fishman on pickups for both the Tele set and for the P90 set. But I'm working on a new guitar with them. That's coming out in May, as a matter of fact. And that'll have a new version of my Fishman pickups as well as a new guitar from Reverend. And that's been a cool thing. I mean, as you know, as we've discussed, I mean, I did the Fender thing for years, and I was always a
right.
you know, kind of a, just a classic Fender Gibson guy, you know, Fender, right. Gibson, Martin, you know, that's what I did. And I continued to do that. I had that relationship with Fender and I, you know, I was never an employee. I always had this weird, relationship with them where I did business with Fender entities all over the world as their quote unquote ambassador, their words, not mine. I'd go in and do clinics or gigs or whatever. But never really had a solidified relationship with them. In a way that worked to my advantage as well, because I didn't have to kowtow to anybody per se. But then when, you know, they sold the company the first, and when Bill Schultz got out, and then when Bill Mondello got out, you know, then it was like a whole new squad of people to have to schmooze. And I was just like, you know what? I can't do it. I've busted my ass doing this shit for these people all over the world. And the last thing I want to have to do is to now reintroduce myself to another cavalcade of bean counters. Right. So, I just kind of found an opportunity through, you know, with Wildwood and, you know, and then Fishman happened. And then it just became, you know, Ken and I from Reverend just really hit it off. And I just really liked the, you know, more of the family aspect of them running the business, and just, he's a working musician who has a guitar company. And it's just, it's not this corporate Leviathan. Not that there's anything wrong with that, per se, but.
Right, right. And God bless Fender. It's great. It just became like a lifestyle brand.
Right, exactly.
Over the years, which, you know, hey, I mean, I guess if you're in business to make money, that's the goal.
Right. Exactly.
Become a Harley Davidson of guitar.
Exactly.
And then guitar playing was less about really somebody being able to really play guitar as much as just, hey, everybody can play guitar.
Right. Right, right, right.
Which is great. Of course.
Totally.
It's great. So I get it. And I think the Reverend stuff is great. I love the amp. And I had, that's so funny. I had a Koch amp. Like way back, I think in the late 90s, like one of the first ones, like a multi something.
Yeah, multi-tone.
And it was very kind of 5150 heavy saturation, but clear and clean sounding. And so that was really cool. But no, I always like your tone, and I get it. I get it. You got your, the stuff that works for you and the people that you like working with, you know?
Right. And you know, it's, and as you know, being a musician, I mean, you got to have as many different ways to make money as you can, because
absolutely,
and especially some mailbox money. Cause if you're contingent on just having to leave the house in order to make your dough, you know, that you're in a perilous spot, man.
Yeah. It gets tough for sure. You know, I mean, I grew up, like I said, working at that music store. And I grew up, we were pretty poor. We lived in the city. We lived in an apartment. Nobody had any money. So, you know, when I see our friends like Joe Bonamassa, and he's got all of his vintage guitars, you know, I grew up around all of that. And I love it. I think it's great. And Joe is, he's the perfect torch carrier to bring, you know, to keep this alive, these instruments, right. And I love that he plays them. You know, I love that he walks out on stage and plays it like it's worth $800.
Right.
You know,
and he's very generous with letting other people play it.
Right. So I love all of that. But at the same time, I'm like, yeah, I don't want that guitar. Like, that doesn't even interest me. This poor kid in me is like, I want the new guitar that's shiny with the brand new paint job that looks really cool. Like, so, because I could never afford them when I was a kid, you know, people always say, like, every time I see you have a new guitar, I'm like, yeah, it's awesome, isn't it? Like, I could buy a new guitar. I bought a new guitar this week, and I'm going to go play it. And I think another thing of that is, like, I love the idea that, hey, I could play any guitar. Like, I could do my show and play my music no matter what. Just what do you got?
Right.
As long as it'll stay in tune and we can plug it in. Like, I think for some reason I seem to think that's good, and it is. But in my head, I like that. So I've been through so many guitars, and of course, like, you really grew up Fender, got Fender Telecaster, Stratocaster.
Yep.
just kind of that my whole life. And then worked with a great small builder named Mike Delaney for a while, and just gone through so much gear. But finally, in the past year and a half or so, it was like, you know, I've never really ever played a Paul Reed Smith.
Ah.
They were never really available to me. And I decided I would get a Paul Reed Smith. And I got one, and I played it, and it stayed in tune for the entire show. Like,
it's always good.
Now we're I'm a different guitar player. I'll usually bring one guitar to the gig. If we go on tour for 4 weeks, I will bring two, but I will play one for the entire tour. The other one's just there in case, God forbid, something happened. I'm anything I do on the guitar has got to be done on one guitar, because I'm really kind of focused on singing, sure, playing the show, doing the songs, and then it's kind of secondary. So I got to be able to play slide. I play slide in standard tuning. It's just real basic, you know, simple kind of slide guitar playing that works, nothing fancy. And it just needs to be able to stay in tune and get some sounds.
Right.
It needs a treble bleed on the volume control.
Yep.
Because I got to be able to turn the volume up and down, because that's really what I'm going to do all night.
Yep.
I don't want it to be all dark and shit and sounding muddy.
Right.
So I started playing Paul Reed Smith, and it's like, wow, this is really good. I like this. So I got a hold of Rich Hannon at Paul Reed Smith, who was great. He's been awesome. And we, started talking, and I've been playing it now for about a year and a half. I've had several different models. I have the Silver Sky, like the Strat, the John Mayer.
Yep.
Which, I got to be honest, I love it.
It sounds good. I mean, they sound great.
Sounds good. It feels good. And this new album coming out, Life is Hard, I told Rich what I was doing, and I said, I need a red guitar for the album cover and blah, blah, blah. And when it got, they made it for me. When it was ready, he said, hey, this one's on, you know, I don't think they mind me saying. Anyway, they gave it to me.
Sure. Awesome.
And I was so overwhelmed. I thought, I worked for Fender. I've been a Fender artist. I'm not saying anything bad. I've worked with a lot of guitar companies. Nobody's ever given me a guitar before, ever. And I was like, well, that's it. I'm playing your guitars.
Yeah, this is unbelievable. Nice.
It's like the first girl I had sex with in high school. We're getting married, and I'll stay with you forever. It was amazing. So, I really like it. And, listen, truth be told, I brought that. It's a red McCarty single cut. You know, it's kind of the Gibson scale. And it's fabulous. And I brought it to the studio. It's the only guitar I flew to L.A. with. Of course, Joe brought
an arsenal,
a $480,000 59 that was his beater, and a great Strat, a great Tele. We brought, he brought all this stuff, but I mean, about 80% of what I played was that Paul Reed Smith. And every time it would be like, hey, okay, you need to come on, we're gonna do the solo, you need to play the solo. And I go, okay, well, what do you want me to play? And he goes, man, play Paul Reed Smith, sounds good,
yeah.
You're comfortable with it. Just play that.
Yeah.
You know, and he would pick it up and play it and go, yeah, you know, this is good.
Yeah.
This is a good guitar. Yeah. And I was like, it is. And I always threaten Joe. I tell him, you know, one of these days I'm going to buy you a brand new guitar. And he goes, don't do it. Don't do it. I said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to buy you right off the wall at Guitar Center.
Exactly.
So, yeah, man, you know, that's what's going on with me and my gear. I just sold a ton of guitars and amps for the beginning of the year, and I got it whittled down to a reasonable amount, and I'm just sticking kind of with what I'm doing, and I'm playing my Dr. Z amps.
Oh, cool.
The Maz, M-A-Z. To me, that's always been my signature model, because those are my initials, but of course it's not. That's Dr. Z's son's initials.
Now, is that one kind of like an AC30 type of thing?
I think it is. Yeah, it's definitely Vox-ish, but it's more open. It's less compressed to me than a Vox. It's it gets dirty, but not like super saturated at all.
I got you. Yep.
In fact, you run the gain and the master. I've got the 18 watt head that I take with me. And if I run those both on half, oh man, it's wonderful. It's still really loud. I mean, they'll.
So you run an 18 watt amp and that's it. That does the job.
That's it. Yep. 18 watt head with their ZBeth 212 cab. And then, you know, like a pedal, I usually use the JHS double barrel. That's kind of just the Bluesbreaker tube screamer that works. And the sound men always tell me, you're too damn loud. You got to turn down, or can you put a shield? I'm like, really?
Oh my God. When people say that, okay. I go, that's not happening.
Yeah, no, I always tell them, no, we're not going to do that. It'll be fine. Don't worry.
Yeah, when people get in here, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's been a hard thing is...
It's changed.
Man, people want things to and I like, I'll work with them to an extent.
Right.
Like if I'll put a baffle in front of my amp, but you know, Toby, the B3 is loud, man. And then Dylan hammers like a demon. So nice. I know that even when we're on idle, it's going to be loud. So what I like to say is like, well, we just need to find the rooms that are going to take it because.
Yeah. I've also learned. I need to not be the first person to make noise at sound check.
Right.
You know exactly what I mean.
Yes.
Because right away, they're going to be like, okay, hey, that's way too loud. And I go, not when the band starts playing.
Right.
It's not. I do this every night. It's not too loud. Trust me. So now I just wait. I just stay out of the way. Or I turn it down really low.
Right.
And I kind of do that. And then when we walk up on stage to play, I just turn that damn thing up and let loose and to hell with them.
Exactly correct.
You know, they're buying tickets to see Greg or Mike. They're not buying tickets to see the sound man. and the sound man's not in the band.
In Europe, it's especially difficult, especially in Germany. Oh my God, it's so loud. It's, you must turn it down.
I'm like, yeah, they want to play
everything. There's a band here tonight, right?
Right. They want to put it all in the sound system, of course. And then they want to. You nix your sound, and I just say, but you're not in the band. Like, you don't even know how the songs go. Why would you do that?
I don't know if you have made this observation, but for me, it's like, yeah, we're a loud band, but we know how to control our stage volume accordingly. We play with dynamics. We do what we need to be done. So just put the least amount of the PA as possible. But they can't. They always feel that I got to mic everything up, and I got to do this and that.
That's new. That's new, you know, and me and you, we're still from the days before where it was sound reinforcements.
Right.
You had the sound on the stage, and then they put whatever, if the kick drum wasn't loud enough or the vocals, then they put that in, and then you mix around the volume on the stage and to make it where you can hear everything.
Right.
Now, they want it to sound like a pair of AirPods.
Exactly.
You know, and perfect stereo, which is... I mean, unless you had your own people every night, it's crazy.
Exactly.
It's crazy.
I am in total agreement. So let me ask you this. So you moved from the St. Louis area down to Texas. When did that happen?
That was in right before I worked at Fender. I kind of knocked around a little. I had some issues back in the day with drinking and narcotics and things like that.
I have no idea what you're talking about. That seems
that I haven't done in 20 years. I've been sober 20 years this past year.
Oh, good for you.
Thank you. It's better for everybody.
Yes.
It's really good for you. I don't steal from you or take things.
Yes.
No, I kind of knocked around, and then I got the opportunity to move to Texas through Larry Barnes, who was the longest working sales.
Oh, I remember Larry Barnes.
Yes, one of my dear friends. Still, I still try to see him once a year when I go to Florida.
Does he still have that Mercedes? Remember, he had that.
He still has the Mercedes, and he belongs to a Mercedes club. He lives like in Winter Park, Florida. And there's like a Mercedes club that he belongs to where they once a month get their cars together. And he still has a handful of Fender guitars from the early custom shop, like when they took demos out of like crazy looking, stuff. But he helped me get that job and that moved me to Texas. The job was in DFW in Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I moved there and I didn't work there, but maybe 5 or 6 months. Again, because they didn't They were very upset when I used the company credit card to buy drinks at the strip club in Houston for all the employees at Guitar Center while we were out partying. I had to go to Scottsdale and get fired. And they called the strip club on the speakerphone, Greg, in front of me.
Oh, you're kidding me.
And the guy said, oh, the guy from Fender. Yeah, he was here last week. And Alan Waite just busted a gut laughing. And I denied it all. It was pretty hysterical. yeah, it was great. It was called Pulling a Zito for a while.
Pulling a Zito.
All I kept thinking was, this rock and roll, man, Fender, Jimi Hendrix played your guitar. What's the deal?
Right.
You're trying to run a business. I thought we were doing something cool, man, you know? I had met a girl in St. Louis, and she was from Texas, and we started dating. And so then I moved down to Southeast Texas. I live in a town called Nederland. It's kind of between Beaumont and Port Arthur. That's where she was from. That was my lovely wife. And so then I've been here 20 years. And after I got sober, started playing again. And I realized I could make money if I didn't blow the money on booze every night.
Right.
And because of the small town we live in, I had to start driving around if I wanted to play five nights a week. I had to go to Houston. I had to go to Lake Charles, Baton Rouge, Dallas. And that really just kind of got me out on, okay, well, then we're going to go on the road. And whereas St. Louis, I was just playing five, six nights a week all the time.
Right.
Just, you know, making $100 tonight, playing gigs, and which is great. And you can still do that. But it got me on the road. And that really is what kind of opened up my whole ability to kind of build a career of traveling and touring and things
yes.
like that.
And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah.
Well, listen, my friend, thanks so much for spending some time with us today. We're in the midst of Snowmageddon up here. Are you guys getting snow down there?
No, of course not. It's about 60 degrees out here right now.
Nice. Well, they said it was going to be, oh, my God, it's going to be horrible. We're going to wake up and there's going to be 3 inches on the ground. And then by the time it's dinner time, it's going to be, you know, 9 inches. And we woke up and there was barely anything. Now it's snowing a little bit, but it's, you know, it's one of those. I could be incorrect later on tonight. We might actually get walloped, but I find the hyperbole when it comes to these forecasts just to be a little bit much.
Yeah, it's too much. I agree for sure.
But my wife's off from work today because she didn't have to go in because of Snowmageddon. So my son's still home from college. So we're going to be hanging out, causing trouble.
Well, that's fantastic. Listen, Greg, I love you to death. I always have. And I'm honored that you asked me to come and talk with you. We could probably talk for hours and just shoot the shit. And
no doubt.
This was great. This was great. By all means, thank you so much for having me.
A pleasure, and I hope we cross paths soon and get to do a little playing. Always fun.
Please, I need a guitar lesson.
Ah! I don't even know what I'm doing anymore. It's
I don't know why they call it a 13. There's only...
That's right. I don't know. There's only 8 well, notes no, or 7 no. or something. I don't know. All right, my friend. Take it easy. Thanks again.
Thanks, Greg.
Have a good one. Folks, thanks so much for tuning in. We certainly do appreciate you stopping by and partaking in the most savory, chewable gristle this side of Cucamonga. Gregory Kalk, looking forward to seeing you again next week, even though I won't actually see you, but I'll sense your presence.